Welcome to News and Brews. I'm Mike Heslin.
And I'm Errol Yabuke.
Last week, we talked about Elon Musk joining the board of Twitter. For our first story this week, who knew he wouldn't even make it to one Scaramucci?
We also dissect the Macron-Le Pen rematch from 5 years ago in France before doing the whirlwind tour de COVID from Philadelphia to Shanghai and back home here to D.C.
We'll let you listeners decide which disease is worse, COVID or Marine Le Pen.
You know what's worse than both?
I do. It's us not doing anything on climate change. That is our main story for today. The 6,000 plus pages of recent IPCC reports and the reaction or lack thereof to them.
Stay with us. We read all 6,000 pages. You know what's worse than all of that?
What's that?
Genocide. Genocide always, is worse.
Always the what's worse trump card.
Always the what's worse trump card. But we'll get to that in our spicy nuggets.
All right, let's get into it.
Let's do it. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Errol.
Welcome home.
Great to be back. Great to be back home, back recording. We're doing this a little bit out of the usual rhythm this week, because I was on the road and unable to find a good time to do the recording on our usual Tuesday. We're now recording on Wednesday, and it's new and different. You got to keep things fresh, you know?
It's weird. I don't know that I like it, but it's fine. We're flexible. Nothing if not flexible. Where'd you go?
I was in New Hampshire, back at my alma mater, Dartmouth, giving a talk to some undergrads in a management and leadership development program.
Some impressionable young minds.
Got to shape them.
Did you talk about the podcast?
I did mention the podcast. Actually, the awesome student assistant who was introducing me mentioned the podcast, which was very nice.
Nice.
Yeah.
It's part of who you are now, Mike. It's like part of your intro.
Yeah, I need to start leading with it. I think it's like a little too close to the end of the bio right now. So we'll switch it up.
Yeah, Mike, comma space, podcast host.
Just Mike News and Brews Heslin.
Has a nice ring to it.
Mm-hmm.
Has a nice ring to it. What are you drinking tonight?
So before we get to that, I think there is something that all the people are wondering about, which is how's the book coming along?
Oh, the book. I like to say that I'm in the research phase. But actually, I have actually started writing. I drafted a prologue, got a couple chapters down. I'm about to be on an 18-hour flight on Saturday, and so I'm hoping that I will get some writing done then. But yeah, it's progressing. I'm like testing out this whole get up at 5 thing.
Wow.
Which, as a night owl, I'm sure you would love. yeah, I try to be in bed by like 9:30, and I wake up at 5.
I'm very impressed.
Yeah, don't be yet. I mean, it's like trying is the operative word, but
sure.
It's, you know, it's a bit like developing a habit. It's going to take a little while. So now, I have to say, it's been so fun. Like, cool. I write for a living, as many listeners know, and like, just the like juxtaposition of like, on Monday, I spent most of the day writing about like how drones probably create more terrorists than they kill. And it's a piece that is bound to just piss off everyone. Like, the activists are going to be like, why are you using military terms? And the military is going to be like, why are you a tree hugger? And it's just going to be great. It's going to piss off literally everyone.
Yeah, but it probably won't piss people off as much as like seeing their family get killed with drones, though, you know?
No, I think those people will really like it. But actually, that's not the audience for this. But I digress. The point is, I was doing this on Monday, and then on Tuesday morning, I got up and I like started writing about like a mid-1960s scene on a farm in North Texas. And I was just like Googling like Harper's Magazine covers in 1965. And it was just fun. It's just straight up fun. So
cool.
I don't know if this thing will ever get done. I don't know if anybody will read it, but I'm certainly having a good time.
And where's the 18-hour flight to?
Singapore.
Excellent. So you'll be out next week. We may or may not have a News and Brews episode. You know, stay tuned. Follow us on the socials.
On the socials, we will announce. Yeah, it turns out this particular flight is from Newark, New Jersey to Singapore, and it is the longest commercial flight on the planet.
Amazing.
18 hours and 45 minutes.
Well, Godspeed.
Yeah, thanks. Hopefully tailwinds
is yes. what I'm
praying for. Tailwinds and an upgrade. That's what I'm hoping for.
Cut that right down to like 17 and a half hours. It'll be amazing.
It'd be great. Mind blowing.
So what are you drinking tonight?
So I like how you didn't answer my question, turned it around, and then now answered me or asked me a question. I'll take it. It's good. I have sort of a twofer tonight. So I've got a Right Proper Brewing Company Fear No Art IPA, which as Team Heslin knows, it was my wife's birthday this last week. And so we all got together at a brewery.
It was. And not only that, it was about 10 degrees colder than it was supposed to be. And none of my family dressed adequately. So my jacket went on to my daughter and I had to replace that with several of those very beers that you are drinking right now.
Yeah, no, you did a good job. I mean, you looked like surprisingly comfortable in your t-shirt in like 34 degree weather. It was great. So I've got the Right Proper, but I am drinking it in a pint glass that celebrates Patrick and Natalie Christian's wedding, in part because one of my best friends, Natalie, it was her birthday yesterday, and they started a brewery. More cool. Specifically, he started a brewery. It's called Great Heights Brewing Company. It's in the Heights in Houston. And it's really stinking good beer. They have great labels because that's important. And it's just like a really cool thing that they're doing. I think we're getting to the age, like your friends own a winery in California. And like, I think we're just getting to the age where like our friends are doing some cool shit like that. So, you know, cheers to Natalie Christian.
Amazing. I'm drinking a Victory Sour Monkey Sour Triple. Do you like sours?
You know, I haven't delved into them, but that sounds doubly sour.
Yeah, you would think it's triple sour from the description, but it's not. I'm actually not that into sours, but this is like kind of nice. It's sort of subtle and it's got a cool can with a monkey on it. And so I really can't complain.
Wait, let me see the can. Approved. It's like a monkey covering its eyes with its tongue open. It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Support.
Should we talk about the news?
Let's talk about the news.
All right. So last week we talked about Elon Musk joining the board of Twitter.
Yes, it was excellent. I really enjoyed Tech Bro Mike. It's like my favorite Mike.
I think as of this week, we should maybe call him M. Night Shyam Elon, because this week we have a plot twist.
I see what you did there.
That's like maybe my favorite joke I've ever made on News and Brews. So thanks for bearing with me.
I think most of News and Brews listeners will actually get it, which is like makes me feel very happy.
On Monday of this week, Musk announced he will not, in fact, be joining the board of Twitter, though he will remain its largest shareholder. The reversal comes amid speculation that shareholders and the SEC could have taken action against him if he did join the board, since we now know that he had already approached Twitter's leadership about joining the board when he submitted his SEC filing after the deadline and listed his investment as passive instead of active, which there's really nothing more active than investing in a company than joining its board.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where last week you talked about like, you know, he's got some brilliant ideas, but then there's like all that other stuff that's bad. This seems to be like on the moral weirdness side for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And the legal weirdness side too, because in fact, we learned on Tuesday this week that Twitter shareholders are suing Musk over that delay in disclosing his stake in the company. The law says you have to notify the SEC within 10 days whenever your stake in a public company surpasses 5%.
Yeah, so I guess that's what I was. I guess that's what I was trying to say. Sorry to interrupt. That's what I was trying to say when I was like moral, because like you know that he's got to know this. He's got to know what the law is, right?
Yeah, yeah, and I or someone he's paying does, right?
Yeah,
yeah. The law is designed to protect the other investors. So often, a single person or entity amassing a stake that large is a sign of a takeover bid or an activist campaign, these things that tend to raise the share price. And so failure to disclose under this rule allows that big investor coming in to buy up more shares at the pre-price increase level while depriving the sellers of those shares from those gains.
Yeah.
And yeah, specifically in this case, given how many additional shares he bought in that period after he crossed the 5% threshold and how much the share price rose when he did announce his stake, Musk delaying his disclosure from the deadline of March 24th to the actual date he filed, which was April 4th, netted him $156 million at the expense of other shareholders.
It sounds like a lot of money.
You have to think this guy's set for life now, right?
It's, of course, not for Elon Musk, but like also shady as all get out, because like he knew that when he announced this, the share price was going to jump, right? And this is why he did it. Like he bought this like surreptitious shares and then was like, you know, several days later was like, oh, and I'm joining the board. And therefore I made $156 million like in a drop of a hat.
Yeah, I think he's sort of,
I'm not
singular.
A fan. Did you get that? I'm not a fan.
He's sort of singular in the like cultish following he has that will follow his signals kind of wherever he goes. I think there are a lot of big investors, you know, when Warren Buffett goes and invests in a company, there's other money that pours in after him. But in terms of really reaching the highly online retail investors that I think through the pandemic have become way more active, particularly given the emergence of new platforms like Robinhood, he just has the ability to move stocks in a way that few others do. And he certainly knows that.
Stocks and like other things like Dogecoin, right?
Yeah.
Didn't he like inflate Dogecoin? Am I mixing this up?
No, he did. And Scott Galloway, who's an NYU professor and hosts a couple of podcasts, had a really thought-provoking take, even as it was, I think, openly hostile to Elon Musk for very transparent reasons of financial self-interest. But one of his main points was that when Elon gets involved with things outside his core family of companies, which, as we talked about last week, had a ton of value and he's done pretty exceptional things with, when he gets involved in things outside of that core, he brings volatility instead of value. So Dogecoin is a great example of that, where he kind of hyped it up and then went on SNL and said it was a hustle and it crashed and it was just this whole thing. Another one was the cave rescue in Thailand. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, I do. I forgot that was him, but I did remember.
Yeah, he like sent over like some submarines that like didn't work and then like called the guy who was actually doing the rescue a pedophile on Twitter. There were issues, a similar episode with Etsy, where he started kind of hyping up the company and then it like rose and crashed. GameStop, when they were going through that whole saga, he kind of added fuel to the fire. So we'll link that episode it was on the Pivot podcast, which I actually really like and would recommend. We'll link that episode in the show notes, but particularly the conversation around Elon Musk. This was last week. So after he announced he was joining the board, before he announced he was not joining the board, but just like a really thoughtful take.
Fascinating. Well, thanks for closing that loop for us. I know so many people were so excited about Elon Musk joining the board.
continue tweeting freely, everyone.
I think with him, they would have been able to tweet even more freely. And, you know, Donald Trump probably would have got his handle back and all that fun, you know, free speech jazz.
He may still. We'll cover it.
He may still.
Hi, everyone. Mike here. So we recorded this episode on Wednesday night, and well, come Thursday morning, M. Night Shyamalan brought us another surprise twist when he made a hostile takeover bid to buy Twitter and take it private for $41 billion, which is about a 20% premium over its current market cap. In a letter to the chairman of Twitter's board, Musk said, quote, "I invested in Twitter as I believe in its potential to be the platform for free speech around the globe, and I believe free speech is a societal imperative for a functioning democracy. However, since making my investment, I now realize the company will neither thrive nor serve this societal imperative in its current form," end quote. Many Twitter users are skeptical about this offer. Rene D'Arresta, who's an expert on misinformation and the systems that spread it at Stanford, distilled Musk's offer well, saying, quote, "I have to buy and take this public square private in order to save it. Try saying it out loud. It sounds ridiculous. Hero complex nonsense. But so are the ideas that, one, we should have a global public square, and two, that there's no quote-unquote moderation in the public squares we do have." That's the end of her quote. It remains to be seen how Twitter shareholders will react, but two big questions jump to mind for me immediately. Number one, Where is Elon's financing coming from? Yes, he's the richest person in the world, but so much of his wealth is tied up in his companies. It's not likely he has $41 billion in liquid assets just lying around. It's important to know who else is investing with him, particularly if it is other, you know, misinformation anarchists using free speech as a fig leaf like Peter Thiel. Number two, what other offers are coming in? There's been plenty of interest in buying Twitter from other private groups, and you could see big companies like Apple or Alphabet, or even, you know, Musk's old stomping ground at PayPal getting value from it as well. Either way, we definitely haven't heard the end of this story, and I'm sure there'll be more twists to come, so stay tuned.
I want to cover the French election. So there was an election in France, and I don't know how many people have been paying attention to this, but I think it's kind of a big deal. Not just because there's an active war in Europe, but, you know, I think France is sort of a bellwether for the rest of Europe. And so just a little bit on what's happening. So they did have an election, more like the beginning of an election. So unlike in the United States, most people probably know this, but just to recap, unlike here, where we stay up all night and we drink whiskey and pray and hope and wish and wonder about the future of democracy and drink some more and then maybe switch to beer and then go back to whiskey and...
Right. You're saying over there, they just drink wine and smoke cigarettes.
Right. And I also feel like I was getting a little bit of my own memories there. but so unlike here, where we usually know the winner on the night of, obviously we didn't know Joe Biden for a couple of days, but like, you know, we know fairly quickly after one round of voting. The French, as you mentioned, stay up all night smoking cigarettes and drinking wine. And just for the privilege of knowing who will be, wait for it, in the next round of the election. Mm-hmm. So this last Sunday, those in France who also care about democracy waited to see if current President Emmanuel Macron could at least finish in the top two, because it's the top two that go on to face one another face to face in a runoff in 2 weeks' time. Side note, let's vote on Sundays. That's a good idea. So back to France. Lo and behold, he did finish. He finished first with a resounding 27.8% of the vote, which of course in the United States, we're like, what?
For the non-mathematicians, that's not a majority.
That is not a majority. It was, in fact, a plurality, as we'll talk about here in a second. But, you know, if he had gotten 50% plus one votes, then there actually wouldn't have been a runoff. But that hasn't happened really in recent history. So,
because they have like a multi-party system, right?
They do have a multi-party system. And it's, I think this election, and I'd like your thoughts on this too, Mike, this election sort of is calling into question sort of the traditional parties and are there rise of new parties on the left and the right. And so there was a far left candidate in this. So Macron, you know, bills himself as a sort of centrist, maybe even in French terms, like center right, but just this like centrist character. And there was a far left candidate, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who came in a close third, just behind far right candidate Marine Le Pen. And so again, Macron got 27.8, or let's call it 28%. She got 23.1% of the vote. And Marine Le Pen is, for those who have followed French politics perhaps for a while, she is the daughter of fellow far righter Jean-Marie Le Pen, who founded the National Front Party in the 1970s. Along, I think everybody agrees, pretty racist and anti-Semitic lines. Mm-hmm. And so Le Pen, the daughter, has tried to bring the party more into the mainstream over the last decade, you know, masking, you know, racist ideology with things like Make France Great Again, for example.
Yeah. And she renamed the party from National Front to National Rally. And it's just like fucking wild that that's working.
Yeah, it's totally working. She even expelled her dad from the party as part of this, like, you know, rebranding image. He had said some pretty terrible things about Nazi gas chambers, which I won't repeat here. But that attempt to move in the mainstream, you know, hasn't meant that she's like deviated much at all, if at all, from her father on things like immigration. Mm-hmm. So she does fancy, the make France again joke aside, like she does fancy herself a bit of like a French Trump, although she predates Trump in French politics. But seeing Donald Trump's success, I think she's tried to replicate some of that. And by focusing on this sort of forgotten working class,
yeah,
you know, and, you know, while she still has and has for pretty much her whole political career had immigration and anti-Islam at the top of her agenda, this time she's actually talking about, like, as we would say in the United States, like she's talking about kitchen table issues.
Yeah.
She's talking about, like, you know, the price of fuel and, you know, why things are so expensive and, you know, other people are taking our jobs and it's not like it used to be.
Right. But as you said, and I think this is from the US and sort of broader Western liberal democracy perspective, all the more worrisome because her platform still is centered on Euroscepticism, on anti-immigration, on giving job preference to French citizens over not just immigrants, but even other EU citizens, which flies directly in the face of the EU and would therefore cause some major friction there. Yeah. She has been pro-Putin throughout her career and remains quite soft and open to Putin.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's all right. And Macron has not campaigned at all during this, mm-hmm. during this presidential campaign. Sort of fancies himself as a little bit of like a wartime president. You remember he went to Moscow to try to convince Putin to back down and that didn't work. But he's, you know,
yeah, he's been trying to dress Zelensky chic.
Has he?
Yeah, not for long, but there was like one or two
Charles de Gaulle in a t-shirt.
He took pictures in like the olive shirts. I think he reverted to his like authentic investment banker roots pretty quickly after that, but he gave it a go.
Oh, that's amazing. I did not see that. That's awesome. So this more nuanced Marine Le Pen is now going to go head to head with Macron in 2 weeks. They did this back in 2017 and it wasn't close. Like mm-hmm. I think he had like two votes to every one of hers, but this is 2022. It's not 2020. It's not 2017. There's a pandemic. Macron is not as popular as he was. Inflation is an economic and a political problem. Her message has changed, as we talked about. I think Marine Le Pen could legitimately win. I hope she doesn't, but she could legitimately win.
Yeah. And Macron is now, you know, now that I think there are 2 weeks between the first and second rounds, and he is now campaigning quite aggressively and actually on that very message. I think saying, basically he's saying what I would want to say, which is we've seen this happen in the US with Trump. We've seen this happen in the UK with Brexit. Like, don't do this. It's very realistic that this could happen. Don't do this, France. There's been some really good coverage of this in The Economist on their daily podcast. They had an episode on it in the last week. And their analyst was saying that often in these French elections, because they are two rounds, you see people really trying to express their voice in the first round and saying that, you know, this is the candidate that I really like. And as you mentioned, there's a wide range to choose from. Interestingly, the socialist candidate, which, you know, the last president prior to Macron was socialist, the socialist candidate, Anne Hidalgo, who's the mayor of Paris, who's done some really kind of awesome things in Paris, at least from like the urbanist perspective, like, you know, closing off significant parts of the city to cars, making it just much more livable, got 2% of the vote.
Yeah.
So just to underscore your point that the traditional center left, center right parties have really broken down and Macron has kind of tried to take up the mantle of moderation and relative centrism amid the rise of extremes on both sides. So that's in the first round, right? People want their voice to be heard. But in the second round, they more often than not decide to make a statement about which candidate they don't want in office. Mm. And so I think the hope is that, you know, that for all of the repositioning and renaming of parties and surface level moderation, that you know, that the French public will kind of see through that with Le Pen and still come to the realization that that's not, you know, who they want to be their leader as a country.
And I think that's probably right. I'm no scholar of French elections, but, you know, maybe there's like a Bernie to Trump voter, which certainly was a thing in the United States. And mm-hmm. so like, you know, the Mélenchon, like far left voters, I mean, he got like 22 something percent of the vote. I mean, that's like a very significant part of the vote went for this, like, you know, pretty far left candidate.
Yeah.
And are those people going to vote for Marine Le Pen? Okay, maybe there's like the Bernie Trump thing, but more often than not, they are going to vote for the whoever is not Marine Le Pen. Mm-hmm. Or, and this is the biggest fear of like political operatives the world over, they're just not going to vote.
Mm, yeah. So on the domestic side in the US, there was a really excellent comment on this first round of the French election, which came from lumpy male fembot JD Vance. who others may know as the author of Hillbilly Elegy and current candidate for Senate in Ohio. He said on Twitter, "I have a buddy in France and they just had an election there. Polls closed a few hours ago and they already know who the winners are. Must be nice to live in a first world country."
Oh, what a hot take.
Which prompted a range of responses, several of which mentioned, you know, the point you made that they do things like hold their elections on weekends so that more people can participate in them. One response came from Jamel Bowie, which was, "I would also like to abolish the Electoral College and move to a national popular vote with runoff voting, preferably some form of ranked choice, along with national standards for voting registration and ballot access." So we're always here for the J.D. Vance self-owned.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that like hot take in response to the not so hot take. I mean, I wish our elections looked more like France. Yeah, that's great. Should we move on to COVID?
Sure, why not?
So there's a couple of COVID stories. We haven't talked about COVID as much recently, I perhaps out of wishful thinking more than anything, but
I remain on the record saying COVID's over.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to have to wear a mask for 18 hours and 45 minutes on Saturday. So it's not so much. So not so much also for the residents of Philadelphia who start next Monday having to wear masks inside again. And so sunny Philadelphia, land of mediocre baseball, terrible football, underdog boxers who beat tall Russians in the hometown of a prince who moves to Bel Air. You know, I think they're the first big American city to go back to mask mandates. And I think the question that everyone is asking is like, are we going back to mask mandates? And it's basically, I think public health officials in Philadelphia and across the country are seeing cases rise. We're seeing it here in the DMV area and in the Washington, D.C. area as well. It's essentially, the story is that the Omicron variant BA.2, which is awesomely and terrifyingly called Stealth Omicron, is extra contagious and is now the dominant variant in the US. This is also the one that's been tearing through Europe, et cetera. So interestingly, as an aside, the Stealth name actually comes from the fact that BA.2 looks more like the Delta variant under a microscope. Even though it's technically Omicron. So in any case, if you live in Philadelphia, our robust listenership in Philadelphia, unfortunately, you're going to have to go back to wearing masks inside on Monday.
Bummer.
Bummer for them. Perhaps bummer in the future for us. So over to China. So here's, I think, the most sort of significant COVID story of the last several weeks has been in China, where things are not going well. And of course, I'm not talking about their limitless friendship with Russia. I'm talking about how zero COVID is perhaps something that worked early in the pandemic, but it is not working with the highly contagious Omicron variants, including Stealth Omicron. Stealth Omicron's like, LOL, like zero COVID, nice try. So Shanghai is now entering its third week of essentially total lockdown. So 25 million people. This is like the beating heart of China's economy, and it's been closed for business totally for 3 weeks. So
yeah,
these lockdown, like I remember being on lockdown and we could still kind of go to the grocery store. We just like felt like we had to wear a hazmat suit and then take a shower when we got home and stuff like that. Well, people are not even allowed to like leave their homes. Yeah. Right. So they can't even go out to get food. Their food served. Like people are going hungry for fear of getting sick from COVID. Sick people are not allowed to get treatment for other infinitely treatable diseases and illnesses,
including like chemotherapy, like very important treatments.
Yeah. Like important treatments. They're just like the zero COVID stuff is basically setting them back economically, socially, health-wise, like from every conceivable metric.
Yeah, there was a video last week that showed up on Chinese social media where residents in Shanghai were going out on their balconies to, you know, sing and protest that they didn't have supplies, like, you know, somewhat similar to what we saw all over the world in the initial round of lockdowns.
Yeah.
But in this case, there's a drone flying by and it's got a voice coming out of it in Chinese, and the drone is saying, please comply with COVID restrictions, control your soul's desire for freedom. Do not open the window or sing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Land of the free, home of the brave. Speaking of which, while no one would venture to say that the U.S. handled the early pandemic well in this country, it's actually coming out that, you know, like our death rates were just so ridiculously high. And like, we didn't need to go for zero COVID, like to do a lot better than we did. Mm-hmm. But silver lining of a very terrible situation is that early suffering prepared us for the approaching endemic stage way before and way better than China's zero COVID policies. Like mm-hmm. nobody has gotten COVID in China. So there's like no like immunity hurt or otherwise. Older people have really low vaccination rates. I don't know about you, Mike, but like everybody I know, I feel like has gotten COVID at least once. Like I feel like the guy in the Matrix having not gotten it yet, but like everybody has it. Everybody that I know at least has the vaccine. Our vaccines are much more effective than Sinovac, mm-hmm. the Chinese vaccine. So I'm not optimistic about what Shanghai and the rest of China is going to go through.
Yeah.
I mean, look, they're opening up soon, it seems, in Shanghai, but like part of the city, I was reading today that part of the city has actually opened, but it's only like a fourth of the population. Hmm. And like for the reasons that we talked about, like I don't see if they continue with the zero COVID thing, I think China's leaders are going to have some really tough decisions to make, and they're probably going to try to communicate them via drone with some like really like Animal Farm messaging.
Yeah, I mean we talked about this when Omicron, you know, the non-stealth version was starting to emerge, but over time, as the rest of the world moves into the endemic phase, a zero COVID policy becomes totally untenable. And they get to a point where they have no good options. They can either keep having this happen where you have to lock down, you know, the largest city in the world and some of the other largest manufacturing hubs like in Shenzhen, which were locked down last week. And it's just going to keep happening. Or because, you know, their vaccination rate isn't that great, in large part because the Chinese Communist Party has sowed disinformation and skepticism about vaccines. You know, if they relax that policy, things will get very bad for them in terms of death rates very quickly.
Yeah. And you know, unfortunately, I think that might be in their future because I'm not sure, you know, stealth COVID is going to play ball with the zero COVID stuff. By the way, just a quick note again on stealth COVID, like this highly contagious variant having nothing, the like name for it having nothing to do with its actual level of contagion is just fabulous. Love
yeah.
it. Another thing that happens in DC that is fabulous every year is the Gridiron Dinner. And so for our last sort of COVID update, I want to take us back home here to the DMV area. The Gridiron Dinner, as people in DC who aspire to go to things like the Gridiron Dinners know, is the tuxedo and fancy dress gala for eminent political and media poobahs. This year's dinner was held on April 2nd, which is a couple weeks ago now. And by all accounts was, you know, great fun. People were back at it. And then COVID took the T-bird away. So of the hundreds of people in attendance, low hundreds, I think, like 72 people who attended the Gridiron Super Spreader Dinner were ended up with COVID.
Yeah, it was like more than one in 10 people.
Yeah, it was more than one in 10, which, like, I don't know what the definition of a super spreader event is, but maybe that's like what Merriam-Webster needs to adopt. Attorney General Merrick Garland, New York Mayor, the new New York Mayor Eric Adams, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo, Senator Susan Collins, a couple of representatives, and for good measure, President Biden's sister Valerie. I also saw that Nancy Pelosi, who was not at the Gridiron Dinner, also tested positive for COVID. So needless to say, I'm very happy that Congress is getting rid of all the COVID funding moving forward. That sounds like a good idea.
Yeah. It's not great. The thing that I see as the real silver lining here is that prior to reading up on this story, I had no idea what the Gridiron Dinner was.
Oh, and really?
Now that I know what it is, I take some pride in having not known what it was.
Oh, you're such a bad DC person. Yeah, it's like the what's that other one with newspaper? Like
the Correspondents' Dinner.
The Correspondents' Dinner. That's the famous one. This one is like a little bit, I think, shishier. The Correspondents' Dinner forever, for me, will forever be like watching Donald Trump sit there and like take the jokes and then just like seethe and be like, I'm going to win the next presidential election. Like,
yeah, maybe those were not the best jokes to make at that moment, you know?
It turns out, hindsight, etc. Shall we get into our main story?
Let's do it. So it's been a while since we've talked about climate change.
Which is our bad.
You know, it is our bad, but it's not just our bad. So let's talk about some of the stuff that's been happening. The UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, as its friends call it, released its latest report, Climate Change 2022, Mitigation of Climate Change. A few key facts to cover about this. This was the report from Working Group 3 of the IPCC, which focuses on mitigation efforts. This
really
is different,
fact.
Different from Working Group 2, which focuses on the vulnerability of socioeconomic and natural systems to climate change. Right. The new report clocked in at 2,914 pages, much more digestible than the last month's report from Working Group 2, which was 3,675 pages.
And yeah, we talked about that one.
If you bear in mind that War and Peace is only 1,225 pages, you're maybe starting to get a sense of why we as humanity are so fucked.
You didn't read the report?
It seems like, honestly, I tried. It seems like they're doing good science here, just with like zero capacity to communicate their findings or mobilize a response in any way. The IPCC is like a canary in a coal mine, but the miners are all deaf and it has no other tools.
It's so funny. Like, so I've worked in academia before, and without naming names, like so many times people are like, oh, I want to write this so that policymakers and like the public can understand it. And all that means is you take the same language and you make it shorter. So
yeah.
There's like the 30 page intro that is supposed to be like for normal humans.
Yeah.
That is still no. Unintelligible gobbledygook.
It was still 60 pages. And like, and like they, you can even go to like just the charts, which I tried, and they're also completely unintelligible. That's like, great. And I'm pretty good at looking at charts.
That's great.
Like this. So this charts. Isn't all on the IPCC for what it's worth. We have 50% of our political elite that represents about 30% of our country that still denies the basics of climate change and has made it a partisan issue to care about whether or not the earth can continue to sustain human life.
Yeah,
and we have institutions, most notably the Biden administration and the media, that have bought into this bullshit on some subconscious level and downplay it because it's too divisive, or lean on the excuse that this isn't people's top concern. And so I'll share a couple examples of that.
Ooh, please do.
From this last week, one comes from the LA Times. They did have a teaser about the report on their front page, like one of those little like one by one blurbs, like in the bottom corner of the front page, that says, the headline
says, we read this, so you didn't have to.
No, the headline is, Earth on track to be unlivable.
Okay.
The detail says global warming will surpass tipping point unless greenhouse gas emissions fall fast, a report says.
Oh, it's just
and then it says story on page three. It made page three.
Coming next week.
Just like to see, like, you know, existential danger is here now. Like page three.
Page three.
The other one that was just really striking and appalling was from Good Morning Britain, a morning show over in the UK. They had a guest on named Miranda Wellahan, and I have no idea if I'm pronouncing that right, but she comes from the Just Stop Oil Coalition. So she started to explain in this segment their mission to stop new drilling and refining, and then got this response that I'll play for you.
I've got to tell you, we were expecting to get some messages of support from our viewers for you. We haven't had one, not one. We've had nothing but furious complaints from people. Nothing positive at all.
So that you just heard was the host of Good Morning Britain basically telling this activist that the movement to fight climate change is getting bad ratings.
Yeah, it's barely audible, but the scoff that this guest, what's her name, Miranda, gave was just the scoff heard around the world. It was
and
so
they,
good.
We'll share the video in the show notes. Her face as he is like just spouting this nonsense is also priceless. The other thing we'll share is she wrote an op-ed in The Guardian after this, noting very clearly the life imitating art aspects of this being don't look up moment.
Yeah.
But we
should share the whole, I think you said this, but we'll share the whole video clip too, because
yeah, I want to actually play her full response right now.
So before you do that though, Mike, the it's important, I think, to know that like before he said this about like they didn't get any good responses, there's a bit that he talks about where he's like, isn't this playground stuff? And he just like is the most condescending asshole. And like uses language that, like, to me at least, like is intentionally trying to be demeaning to her, both as a young person and a woman. And just like keep that in mind as you listen to what we're about to hear.
Yeah. So this is then, I'm just going to continue the clip from where we left off. This is her response.
I wonder if any of you have read the latest IPCC reports that have come out this year.
Yeah.
You know, what they have said is that we are on the road for climate catastrophe. We are on the road for 3 degrees of warming. This will happen to my generation, to your children's generation, potentially to your grandchildren. And I think we have a moral responsibility to act now. You know, we're supposed to be climate leaders. We're geopolitical leaders. We could set the way for the whole planet by committing to stopping oil, moving to energy efficiency, moving to renewables, moving to yes. insulation. And I think the children and the future deserve at least that.
So, like, thank God for her composure and knowledge, because, like, that could have easily become a Will Smith moment right there.
Yeah, no, she wanted to, but, like, I'm so impressed by her. She's apparently, I think, a university student and has a very bright future ahead of her. So go Miranda.
One other thing I'll call out in terms of the media on this is the New York Times still has a prominent main nav menu option on its mobile app for COVID right next to the home tab. Not just because COVID, as you tried to contradict with facts and news, but I maintain is over. But because climate change is certainly not over, in fact, getting worse, it is an absolute dereliction of duty not to make the climate crisis just as prominent in the way that these publications are covering urgent news for humanity.
Yeah, well, unlike COVID, we're not actually doing anything about the climate.
Right.
It seems.
And now keep in mind, we have a lot of people in our country who think the disagreement itself, division itself, is the problem. You know, pox on both sides houses, any details about who is right and whose party is like a borderline death cult be damned. These are the people who say, oh, well, we just have to wait for technology to fix it.
Yeah. You hear a lot of that.
that is a hugely frustrating argument. And it is also true that we probably need to like focus on making them right.
What do you mean?
Meaning implementing the IPCC's recommendations, building on Paris, actually halting the continued warming of the planet, the continued worsening of climate change, past the 1.5 degree mark, up to the 2 degree mark, up to the 3 degree mark, potentially beyond. That's going to, it would require extraordinary global collective action at this point. That was the main takeaway from these last couple of reports.
Yeah.
Instead, we're seeing war, economic decoupling, and some actors like Russia who may even see a warming planet in their strategic interest.
Oh, I don't think there's a may in there. They definitely do, because the warming of the planet and climate change actually opens up new sea routes and opens up access to new like underwater oil reserves that they didn't have access to before. Like they, I'm pretty sure this is like a Russian policy document, like yay, climate change is making Russia stronger. So yes, I think there is global action needed. It's worth pointing out that the US and China together are responsible for upwards of 40% of greenhouse gas emissions, right? And so, yes, this is a problem of collective action. It's also a problem of like two major emitters just not really having their shit together. And so there's a really interesting piece that I saw this week that we'll link in the show notes by two Johns Hopkins professors. It was posted on the Brookings website about how the US needs to treat climate policy as economic policy. Not, this is an important distinction, not elevate climate policy to be at the same level as economic policy, but treat it as economic policy. Honestly, this makes sense to me because businesses in the private sector are really powerful in this country, and they're really powerful everywhere. And I'm not just talking about like from a lobbying, like government affairs perspective, but from the ability to make big change if they want to, if it is in their interest to do so. So I don't want to diminish government policy here. Government is really important, but society changes, I think, when it becomes routine for the private sector to do things, right? So I wasn't alive when this was happening, but unions fought for a 40-hour work week and overtime pay, which was super controversial when it was proposed. Now it's like standard. Nobody bats an eye. Minimum wage, same. Paid family leave. Okay, I'm not going to go that far. But even there, companies are taking the lead in the absence of broader political will. I'm not trying to deify companies here. I'm just saying like, when, if it, let's go back to climate. If climate policy and economic policy stay separate, even if climate policy actually like gets onto the New York Times ticker instead of COVID or whatever it is, like, you know, even if it's elevated, if it stays separately, the private sector businesses will continue to feel like this is a nice to have, like something they're doing for the benefit of the planet, something they can put in an ad or a commercial. Being less shitty to the environment won't be something they do because it is economically advantageous for them to do so. Let's be real. The bottom line is that the bottom line is what matters for most businesses. Like I said, I'll link it in show notes, but this Brookings piece has some interesting ways of doing this. Things like strengthening the competitive position of domestic clean energy sectors, which are at the moment dominated by Chinese industry. And we have a lot of industry. We have a lot of that stuff here in the United States, but like, it's just not competitive right now. And so we can actually do that by doing things in the minds of these two professors, like improving financing for the domestic clean energy sectors. They call for a national lending institution to be created for this. I'm guessing that's something like Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, but I don't know. They call for a reduction in the investment uncertainty via more stable, which I'm assuming means government-backed domestic market environment for low-carbon technologies, like take some of the risk away. And I think this is a really important one, like focusing on updating and reskilling the workforce for this new
the universal panacea of retraining. Love that.
Yes. Let's retrain the coal miners. So look, I don't know enough about the space or those particular prescriptions to like know if they, those Hopkins professors know what they're talking about. But the argument to consider climate policy as economic policy makes a ton of sense to me.
Yeah, I think you have a real short-term, long-term problem here. I mean, I think like a year ago, we all would have expected that given the climate platform Joe Biden came into office with and given the concrete proposals he had in the Build Back Better legislation and in a number of executive orders he wanted to implement, that he would have been very receptive to this case. What we're seeing instead is that as you know, the crisis in Russia is affecting energy prices, food prices, overall inflation, instead of making the case that it is in our economic interest to get off of oil, which gives Russia a whole bunch of cards they can play economically and geopolitically, instead we are, you know, releasing more from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, 1 million barrels a day for 6 months. We are relaxing fuel standards on gasoline over the summer, where you can add in more ethanol, which will result in more smog in our cities, but will reduce gas prices by like 5 to 10 cents a gallon. And it feels like those short-term concerns, this isn't anything new, but those short-term concerns in an election year are overshadowing this very clear but longer-term economic interest.
Yeah, I think that's all right. And I, in an election year, it's like entirely predictable that the only thing that anybody wants to talk about is high gas prices and high inflation. They don't want to talk about jobs numbers. They don't want to talk about Ukraine. They just want to talk about like these pocketbook issues. So it makes sense to me why that would be a focus. I think you can walk and chew gum at the same time. Like, I think you can work towards economically incentivizing a more robust clean energy sector in the United States at the same time that you're trying to like make fuel more affordable. Like, we're not going to do the green energy transition overnight.
Here's my question. How do we change the law that says gas stations have to have all their prices out there in huge numbers dominating like the Vista on every street in America?
I mean, you'd win elections if they didn't, right?
Like, let's just like be honest that these prices, while they remain quite important, are not determinative of the future of our country. And, you know, you talk about a 5 or 10% difference in a gallon of gas, which is highly noticeable in this kind of an environment, and ultimately redounds to like $2 or $3 to fill up a tank.
Yeah.
This might be my new soapbox. I think it's time to get rid of highly visible gas prices.
I think you're not going to have any takers. I think people are going to be like, it now costs me $65 to fill up my tank, Mike. I don't care.
We won't know till we try.
Fine. You can have your soapbox, Mike. Speaking of soapboxes, can we go to my spicy nugget?
Let's.
My spicy nugget this week comes out of the mouth of President Joseph Robinette Biden. Last week, we talked about how the word genocide wasn't being used to describe what Russia was doing in Ukraine and probably is currently still doing in Ukraine, because the word genocide has a specific meaning in international law. Well, earlier this week, President Biden was in Iowa giving a spicy inflation speech. We didn't talk about inflation, but we should do that in a future episode. But again, this is one on what's on everybody's minds. And so he went to the heartland and talked about inflation. And during that speech, he said, and I quote, "Your family budget, your ability to fill up your tank, none of it should hinge on whether a dictator declares war and commits genocide a half a world away." At which point, genocide Twitter just totally exploded. Like, everybody started freaking out. Like, is this policy? Is this the president going rogue? And of course it was the president. Like, this is not policy. This is like President Biden being like, I've seen enough.
Right. And I do, my favorite part about this is I think you're gonna give some of these details, but after this has now happened like two or three times over the last few weeks, the administration just totally has a playbook for Biden, like going out and saying whatever the fuck he wants.
Jake Sullivan is a master at this. He was asked about this genocide thing. He's like, forget what we call it. It's terrible. Here's the like 13,000 reasons why it's terrible. Biden was actually pushed on it later, and he like doubled down. He was like, I called it genocide because it's become clearer and clearer that Putin is trying to wipe out even the idea of being Ukrainian.
He's not wrong.
He's totally not wrong. And this is why like it's spicy and I like it. this is, I think, what I like really found interesting. And it's hard to say humorous about the situation because it's like so dark. But he went on to say, and I quote, we'll let the lawyers decide internationally whether or not it qualifies. And so with what little I have left of my right proper beer, I salute you, international lawyers. Good luck and Godspeed.
Yeah, I'll right there with you. Cheers. I also have a spicy nugget related to Ukraine this week.
We couldn't avoid talking about Ukraine. We tried and we couldn't avoid it.
There was a big story about a month ago. This was while I was off, but you had a spicy nugget, I think, about it.
Yes.
Which was about the Russian warship. So early in the invasion, you know, somewhere in the Black Sea, there was an island being defended by a small group of Ukrainians. They were told to come out and surrender over the radio by a Russian warship. And their response was, Russian warship, go fuck yourself.
Yeah, this direct has quote.
Became a bit of a rallying cry. I looked it up, and the direct translation is something like Russian warship, go to a dick, which could be interpreted as like go sit on a dick. But I think go fuck yourself works well.
I think it's an appropriate translation.
So that ship is called the Moskva. It is the flagship of the Russian Black Sea Fleet. But I should say it was the flagship.
Nice. Because on
Tuesday of this week, it was hit by two Ukrainian missiles. As of the time of this recording on Wednesday night, the ship is on fire, sending Morse code signals saying it is sinking and its crew has been evacuated. All to say, the Russian warship is in fact going to fuck itself.
It's perfect. It's perfect. Great talking to you, Mike.
As always.
This is a fun one.
Safe travels next week.
Yeah, thanks, buddy. I look forward to seeing in my podcast feed whether or not you record something.
I promise you'll know. You'll be the first to know.
Sounds good. See you in a couple weeks.
All right. News and Brews is hosted by Mike Heslin and Errol Yabuke. Our producer is Alana Nevins. This episode was recorded Wednesday, April 13th, 2022 at 7:30 p.m. Look out for new episodes available each Wednesday on all major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.